So tonight I thought I would talk about the Four Noble Truths, although I really don't expect to get past the first two. Over the years that I've practiced and the number of retreats I've attended, I must have heard at least 50 Dharma talks on the Four Noble Truths. And it's amazing how little I get out of them. My mind grasps the concepts real easily. Oh, the first noble truth is suffering. Well, yeah, I mean, of course, look at the starving children and look at the wars and look at the violence and yeah, well, I mean, what's the problem? Okay, so let's get on to the second noble truth. The second noble truth is looking into the cause of suffering. Again, well, particularly since I've heard the talks, I know which way it's going. It's like, oh yeah, clinging and aversion, you know, that's what causes suffering. It's said that the Buddha taught only one thing, and that was the truth of suffering and the end of suffering. He didn't say there was only suffering. He didn't say all life is suffering. He just said suffering exists, suffering happens, and there is a way that we do not have to suffer as much as we do. Supposedly his first talk to the nuns and monks that were his original sangha was on the Four Noble Truths. And just parenthetically, his first talk to lay people was on generosity or dana. So I spent all these years listening to these, I think, wonderful Dharma talks that were pointing me in the right direction, but somehow I was looking over here. And only about a year ago, I had an interview with Gil, and I told him that my practice felt really stale. I've been practicing 26, 27 years with the breath, and I've gotten pretty good with staying with the breath. Sometimes I make three full breaths or four full breaths, and the mind wanders off. But the real progress is in spotting the mind wandering off in, say, 10 seconds instead of a half an hour. But it felt really stale. Rising, falling, rising, falling, tripped out. Oh, tripped out. Coming back to the breath. Kindly and gently, practicing kindness and gentleness with yourself. So even if you do nothing else other than that practice, it's a very worthwhile practice. You get to cultivate being kind and generous and light towards yourself when you bring yourself back. And Gil said, well, what's going on in your body? Well, I have a body, but I haven't been really paying any attention to it. And he said, I want you to forget the breath entirely. Give it up. I want you to make the body your primary meditation object. Now, I'm a little cautious in saying that because I know that some of you here are or maybe very new meditators. And if you're not even a little bit grounded in the breath, it's probably best to stay with the breath a little longer. But for me, this was like liberation. Oh, I have a body. Sitting here. And Gil cautioned me about not doing a formal body scan. There is a teacher by the name of Goenka, whose whole method of meditation, I understand, is that you are just constantly doing a body scan in a very formal way, looking to see what's there. What Gil suggested was that I just sort of sit back and be in my body and be aware that my body is sitting in a chair, which is where I sit, or on a cushion, and to let that see what surfaces, see what's there. It probably took me a week or two to break the habit. I would kept on going back to my breath, because it's what I've been doing for 25 years. But gradually I got to where I was looking at my body, starting to experience the sensations, physical pain, tightness, and really owning that I had this body, which right now there are days I'd like to give away for a new one. But and in the so it was a bit of a change in my practice, and what I came to discover was that there are an enormous number of things going on in your body. And it's interesting, the first time I talked with Gil, he asked me a question and I started thinking. And he said, well, what are you doing with your eyes? And I said, I don't know, what am I doing with my eyes? He said, well, start thinking hard again. And one of the things I discovered is that I have almost a band of pain that just comes right around because I am so used to thinking so hard that I scrunch and give myself a pain in the neck because it runs all the way back there. After some months of just sitting with the body, Gil then suggested that I use the body as a vehicle for really delving into the Four Noble Truths. And I thought, oh, well, this is going to be a piece of cake. And so I started sitting. My meditation object was my body. I was sitting with it. And I started noticing a number of things, probably first and foremost pain, that has a wonderful way of reaching out and grabbing your attention. You don't really need to go looking for it. And so there was a period of practice where I was learning really to sit with pain, to be with it, and try to be with it without aversion or without clinging to it, without anything with it, but just being with it and observing it. And for those of you who haven't done it, the observation of pain is fantastic. First, because it's relatively easy to focus on. The worse the pain is, the easier it is to focus on it. But pain is not a one thing. It has many, many, many characteristics. It can be hot, it can be cold, it can be a tearing or a stretching, it can be a knotting or bunching, it can be tingling, it may take on a color for you, it's red, it's blue, it may be on the surface or very deep, and perhaps most interestingly, you can look to see whether in fact, pain is solid, or as you hone in on it, whether there are actually spaces between the sensations. And surprisingly, I discovered that more often than not, there are spaces. There's a sensation, and then no sensation, and then the sensation again. So from meditating on the body and starting to pay attention to pain, and then starting to use the sensations in my body as a clue, as an indicator of what might be going on in toto. I sort of set the intention before I sat of looking at the First Noble Truth. And that was really quite a shocker. I mean, okay, we all know about suffering, there's a lot of it out there. But when it got to be this suffering, and then to see the gross suffering, when, God, I don't want to do this anymore. How much longer before my alarm is going off? I don't care how long. Oh, my, 20 minutes. I mean, you know, there are so many dandy ways that we can make ourselves suffer. And again, the gross ones appeared first. Boy, I really would like a chocolate sundae right now, or, you know, whatever it is. And starting to look at that and say, there is a lot of suffering. And then starting to notice all the more subtle forms of suffering, that I discovered that if I had the slightest yearning, I'm not talking about this great big desire to go out and grab something, but if I just had a lean, damn, all there is in the refrigerator is vanilla ice cream and I want a chocolate ice cream, I was already off center and suffering in a small way. It's astonishing to me how many different forms suffering can take. There are really three basic aspects that you can look at when you start getting into the Second Noble Truth. There's the suffering of greed, wanting the time to be over, wanting the time to be longer, wanting more money, wanting more food. I mean, you know, we were born as wanting machines. Almost immediately after you were born, you wanted to be fed. So it's a basic part of our makeup, and to start to see all the ways that manifests and how it can knock us so far off balance, and to be able to experience moment to moment exactly how that's happening, is really a pretty exciting process. It gets to be very interesting. Or, at any rate, it did for me. You may find it boring. And then there's the opposite, the aversion. I got a pain in my leg. I don't want that pain. Go away. I know. I heard that if you really go into the pain, it may go away. So I'm going to really concentrate on the pain, and I'm going to pay attention to it. And I'm not going to have any judgments or anything. I'm just going to experience the pain. And there's a little voice saying, so it'll go away. Well, I don't know how many of you have discovered it never goes away when you've got that, I wish it would go away, because what you've now got is aversion. You have not entered into an accepted, but you are now into fighting it and aversion. And I can vaguely explain it physically. When you're fighting with something, you're experiencing aversion, or you're grasping, your muscles are tensing. And so they will tense around the sore spot and make it sore, more sore. Yeah, it will get worse. So the purity that's needed to really open and experience pain is quite subtle. And I would say 90% of the time, when I say I'm going to just open and experience this, and I don't use the word pain very often because it has a connotation that affects my brain, I'm going to just open to these sensations, and I'm going to investigate the sensations and see where they go, and I'm happy if they stay here forever. Well, 90% of the time I'm lying to myself. I mean, I really want the pain to go away. And then the third way, so there's greed and there's aversion, and then there's ignorance, that when you have no understanding of how things work, it is very easy to get into a great deal of suffering. So as I began to practice that, my first experiences and my first reactions were to simply notice, I'm feeling really tense across the shoulders, and boy, I'm really wanting this time to be over. So there was that tensing around that. There was the aversion. The aversion to sitting and the desire for the sitting to end. And then there are all the other forms of desires, yearnings, that just keep pulling us. Wouldn't it be great if I had enough money so I can go out and get a new car? And the list never ends. You will never have enough money. There isn't any such thing in the world unless you feel you have enough money right now, and then you're in good shape because whatever you have will work. I was a broker, stockbroker for years, and it took me a long time to learn that feeling you have enough money is a function of feeling, not a function of money. So if somebody calls me up and says, when am I going to have enough money to take a trip to Europe? I say never. Because if you don't feel you have enough now, I mean, we can stuff some more into the system, maybe. But your feeling is you're still going to be wondering whether you have enough money to do it. So forget it. Don't just plan on never doing it. At any rate, I had another interview with Gil about 6 weeks ago, just at one of the sittings when there were interview slots. And he said, how's it going? And I said, oh, the first noble truth, you know, I've really experienced how much suffering there is, never mind this whole world, but just in this body, in this mind. I mean, it's enormous. And I told them about the different subtleties. I said, and the second noble truth is a piece of cake. He looked at me. He said, well, you haven't even started on that one yet. If you think it's a piece of cake, tell me why you think it's a piece of cake. And I said, well, because when I look, what I see is there's either clinging and grasping, or there's aversion and pushing away, or there's ignorance so that I'm all confused about what's important and things. And he looked at me and he said, well, what's under all of that? I said, I don't know. So for the last 6 weeks, I've been sitting with my grasping and my aversion and my ignorance and trying to see what is it that's underneath these very large, gross feelings. One of mine is that I don't think I have ever felt, no, not quite, I have rarely felt that I've had enough of anything. Always needed to have more money, more food, more, you name it, and I wanted more of it, except for pain and suffering, by the way. That was the exception. I had no interest in more pain and suffering. So what's underneath that? What's behind this desire? What's driving? What's the driving energy behind that? And I'm starting to see, with a long way to go yet, that underneath that is, I was born in 1934 in the depth of the Depression, and we didn't have very much. And so the whole never getting as much as you wanted was just part of our lives. And although that's really not true for me anymore, I'm still living from that place. So I get to look at that and see what some of these driving energies are. And by owning the energies and experiencing the energies, my hope, my expectations, which means I'm already in trouble, are that by being with those energies and just living them out one at a time, one after another, for however long they are fairly predominant, that perhaps I'll gain some freedom from them. And it's true for aversion. I think I've spent half of my lifetime consciously thinking about how I can avoid being uncomfortable. I will do almost anything to avoid discomfort. So I am constantly planning things so they will work just right. So at 5 o'clock, there'll be a hot shower and a bed. And of course, all that planning never got me anything because nothing ever goes the way I planned it anyhow. There's always extraneous variables coming in. But to see how predominant that is in terms of my experience. So this is a whole really exciting new realm for me in not being satisfied with these very, in a sense, oversimplified answers of, you know, greed and hatred and delusion. To look to see what are the energies, what are the forces that are driving your own particular gestalt of messiness, of suffering, because we'll all have a somewhat different package and they'll all be fundamentally the same. I'm finding that as I work with this, it's really becoming quite exciting. Again, I went to Gill a year and a half ago saying my practice was dry, wasn't going anywhere. And now it's like, oh, wow, there's this whole universe out there that's part of my life that I haven't even begun to explore. And that's with 20 years of therapy on top of it all. I mean, there's so much wonderful subtle material to work with that I think you can probably sense from my presence. I'm stoked. I mean, I'm back to finding, wow, this is really interesting, worth observing, worth experiencing, and really quite exciting for me. Now, I could go on to the third noble truth, which is that there is an end to suffering. And I could give you quite a learned talk on it because I've read a lot of books. But I don't have that experience yet. I'm still with the suffering. So I would prefer not to go to the third noble truth, sit where I am, which is struggling with the second noble truth, and use the next 10 minutes or so to open up to questions. I know the collective wisdom in this room is a hell of a lot greater than mine, so I'd like to hear what other people's experiences are like, to what degree you may have wrestled with these kind of questions, or opening it up widely to any question whatsoever to which I may be able to be helpful and maybe not. So if you don't come up with questions, then you're going to have to just listen to me talk about something I may not know much about.
When you said, you know, why you have that desire to, you know, you never have enough, and you go back to your childhood, your parental upbringing, and then I was thinking, well, you know, people that believe in reincarnation may believe that in their past life that they've had, you know, a real, you know, disastrous life of necessity where they, you know, were at odds. And that's a whole other aspect of, you know, you for psychologically, you know, you can go back into your own life and that's probably enough for you or for anyone. And, you know, but I have done some past life, regression, but not, I found that it was like, well, I have enough to deal with in this lifetime. I don't really want to go back there. But that might be an explanation for some of these things, too.
It may be. I can't comment on that at all. And I'm not willing to go into past lifetimes because I have no experience of past lifetimes. So I would just be giving you theory, stuff I've read in books. There's nothing that I have to offer. I neither believe nor disbelieve. When the Dalai Lama says there are past lifetimes, I have to say, well, I'm not about to argue with him. But the reality is that I haven't experienced it, so it's not true for me. But in going back, say, into my childhood, one of the things, I grew up in a family where people didn't touch each other. And I think I was 40 years old before the first time I experienced what a hug really was. So not getting enough takes, you know, a myriad of forms. And they're not, those forms are not to be clung to. They're not to be, oh, it's my mother's fault. No, it's not my mother's fault at all. My mother and I were very close in her old age, and I'd go to visit her and she would be so excited to see me. I mean, she's 85 or 90 would be almost jumping up and down, and she'd grab me and give me a hug and in a half a second push me away. Now, as somebody who had been meditating and done therapy, that was okay. I knew it wasn't my problem, it was her problem. And the fact that she couldn't sustain that was just how it was. I mean, that's the reality. But that kind of wanting, you know, gets buried. And not that we have to analyze ourselves, but just to experience the depth of our wanting and the form it takes for us is, I think, really important. Past life regressions, if they happen to open up something for you, sounds real exciting to me, but like you, I think my plate is full enough now with this one. I don't need to know about the previous 3,000, and I have no interest in the next 2,000 to come, or however many there'll be. Other questions?
I guess one form of suffering that I have is has to do with more interpersonal relationships and how. You know, sometimes I just have a lot of aversion to just approaching them and with a real questioning mind. And sometimes, you know, your imagination is much worse than what is actually happening, or it may have nothing to do with you, but you feel like there's some tension or there's some uncomfortableness. That, because I'm trying to get to the point where I will just dive right in there and figure it out, try to figure out what the problem is, or if there's a problem, or, try to reach a better understanding of maybe people and in that way see it as an opportunity rather than something to just kind of distance yourself.
When you use the word them a couple of times, and you said interpersonal. So you're talking about meeting new people or even reconnecting with friends, or what's the them?
Disagreement in the workplace, or if there's some tension in the workplace or in just about any interpersonal relationship where you feel some discomfort.
So you're a conflict avoider.
Yeah.
And me
I'm
too.
Afraid.
I'll trade the family store.
Yeah,
make nice.
Just opening up the box and looking inside and saying, "Oh, what is it?" I'll you just try and make it nice.
Well, but I think. Make it.
Yeah. Or.
But the answer I heard you give yourself is that when you said opening up the box and looking into it, you were smiling and you were very excited. Mm-hmm. And so, try opening the box. See what happens. And if it's not working very well, go to the ladies' room. Take a walk.
It doesn't work at home.
I have to tell this wonderful story because it's one of my favorite teaching stories, having nothing to do with Buddhism. Actually came out of the Course in Miracles, and I was doing some workshops with the Course in Miracles, and there was one aspect of it that I loved, which was how they approach forgiveness. But the guy who was teaching these workshops was an incredible guy, Julian Silverman. And tall, Semitic, handsome, super bright. And he knew the Course in Miracles. He'd ask, "Is anybody not know what the Course in Miracles?" There are three books, basically, one of which is real fat. And he'd ask him a question. He'd say, "Oh, on page 414, he'd open up his book. And it was underlined in 9 different colors. You knew he had been through this book a lot. It says right here. So he's doing this workshop, and he starts off. He said, "Look, this is easy. It's Friday night. We can get it all done this weekend, and you can just play for the rest of the weekend if you want." He said, "There's only one thing you have to know. You have one job. And that job is you shine your light, you beam your love at your brothers and your sisters. That's it. That's Course in Miracles. End of story." Well, I was leaving in about 4 days to spend Thanksgiving with the woman who became my mother-in-law, who, was slightly toxic. And so I said, "Julian, what do you do when you're with somebody who's pretty unbearable?" He said, "Weren't you listening?" He said, "There's only one thing for you to do. You just shine your light. You beam your love. That's it." I said, "Julian, I don't think you understood my question. I'm talking about being with a person who's so toxic that the whole atmosphere becomes absolutely polluted and you might die." He said, "Are you deaf?" He said, "You just have one thing to do. You shine your light, you beam your love. That's it. Nothing else to do." I wasn't satisfied. I was suffering. I wasn't getting what I wanted. I said, "Okay, I promise you my last try. So here's the situation. No matter what I'm going to do for the next 3 days, 5 days, whenever it is all going to be wrong. There is nothing I can do that's right. Last Thanksgiving, I cut up the giblets for the gravy. I cut up 9,723 pieces. 6,406 were too large. 2,981 were too small. Not one piece was the right size." I said, "How do you?" He said, "Look, listen, it's very simple. You shine your light and you beam your love. And when you can't do that anymore, get the hell out of there. And that's an important piece, because if you're not shining your light and beaming your love, then you're now part of the toxic problem. You're doing something else. And if it's not light and love, then, you know, who knows? So, you know, long-winded answer to your question is explore the box. Your face was very animated when you thought about looking into the box and experiencing what happens, and there may be some suffering. I you know, this is a lot more of a do as I say than as I do, because I do not like conflict. I will go to great lengths to avoid it, but there are points at which I do become the immovable object. No. Psst, enough. Maybe one more question? Or sure.
Yeah. I don't know if it's a well-formed question, but you were talking about, you know, about your sitting meditation deepening and getting more a better handle on suffering and how it can show up. And then one of the ways that came about for you was having this understanding of what growing up in the Depression, how that formed you. And that you can look and say, well, that's kind of that realization is kind of that part of it could have come about from talk therapy, from any of a number of other things, talking with your siblings or whatever. But then, you know, so there's this one part of the work we do on ourselves is this kind of the normal Western psychological stuff. But then the Buddha wasn't ignoring that, but then he had his own take on it. And I was kind of wondering how you see those two working together and differences, or, like I said, I don't know if it's well formed.
It's well in the form for me, so I can answer it, but it may not be the right it may not be the answer to the right question. The Buddha's model was basically to be with things as they are. I mean, he did not practice psychotherapy. But being with things as they are does include our prior history and our memories. And the trap that I see in therapy is that you can get so focused on what happened 50 years ago that you are totally out of touch with what's going on now. And the 4-year-old boy who felt, without knowing that he was feeling it, deprived because he wasn't hugged or caressed in any way is not who I am now. But it can still, in some sense, be a present factor if it's really in memory. If, however, your mindfulness is strong and you look at that and you say, oh, that's tape number 742 running again, the awareness itself, I think, helps you. You understand that there were these things, so they weren't anybody's fault. They just happened. And you can see those and not get stuck to them, not have them become your treasure, but as a way of just seeing them, being with them, letting them go. And you know, basically the Buddhist practice is letting go of thoughts, letting go of opinions, just letting go of everything. And I will send you all a personal email when I let go of myself. But don't check it every day, because you're gonna be disappointed. So we have maybe 30 seconds. So why don't we just sit quietly? May all beings everywhere be happy. May all beings everywhere be peaceful. May all beings everywhere be well. And may the benefits that might accrue from our practicing and sitting together be for the benefit of all beings everywhere.